Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today, we're listening to A History of the South African Navy, presented by His Excellency John Oxley, Ambassador for South Africa. It was recorded on the 1st of June 1979, and duration is 1 hour and 5 minutes.
Mr. President, Admiral Griffiths, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very flattered to be here this evening to talk to you men who were in blue, although I'm delighted to see that the president of this association was, like myself, an army man. In South Africa, we have an anomalous situation. Anomalous, that is, by British tradition. Because in South Africa, the Navy is not the senior service. It's the youngest of our three services and is the junior one. And indeed, we had an extraordinary situation some years ago when, in the early days of the South African Navy, it was commanded by a soldier. We had a brigadier in charge. I don't know whether it was a gaffe that was made by Army headquarters in Pretoria, dealing over a telex line or a telegraph line with Cape Town, which led to the final conquest of the Army by the Navy. But they tell the story, and still tell it, of how Army headquarters, or military headquarters in Pretoria, got a request for a bosun's chair. They looked up the regulations in Pretoria, and they found that a bosun was the equivalent of an Army warrant officer. They then found that Army warrant officers weren't entitled to chairs. The signal then went back, well, why the hell should a bosun be entitled to a chair? Thank you very much indeed for asking me here tonight. I was a soldier. I don't know very much about the Navy. And you have in your midst somebody who knows far, far more about the South African Navy than I ever have, having had to read up and swap the subject I'm to talk to you tonight. And I talk about Alan Payne, who lived in Simonstown, where I think your father was a naval architect, indeed. And he knows his way about Simonstown, he knows the history of Simonstown, and he knows about the South African Navy far more than I do or ever will. And just finally, before beginning my talk, I just want to assure you, Mr. President, that whatever happened to the QE, I didn't do it. Ladies and gentlemen, you asked me tonight to talk to you about the South African Navy, about South Africa and its Navy. Well, as you know, South Africa is a relatively young country, a little older, albeit, than Australia, and its Navy is even younger. But those few years of the South African Navy have been very active, and indeed still are, and cover much of extraordinary interest. Too much, I'm afraid, to include in a talk of the duration set me tonight. Inevitably, therefore, the contents of the talk I'm about to give must be eclectic, and a lot will have to be left out. Now, it's very difficult to pinpoint exactly when South Africa's maritime and nautical history really began. The indigenous people of southern Africa have no record of interest in the sea. Indeed, the African black regards the sea with fear and with awe and with considerable superstition. There's no history that they had any, unlike the people of the Pacific, that they had any, made any efforts to cross the sea or to have any dealings with the sea. In Africa, the Phoenicians are said to have been the first to have circumnavigated the continent. That was long before the advent of the Christian era. The ancient Greeks knew part of the continent's east coast, as indeed also did the Arabs, as we know, and some of the Asians. But notwithstanding those earlier feats, history honors the Portuguese as the discoverers of the Cape, when in the latter 15th century, one of their explorers pushed beyond the limits of the known routes opened up along the western coast of Africa in a series of searches for a route to the riches of the East. And in a storm, he was blown around the southern end of Africa. For that reason, the Portuguese named it the Cape of Storms, until the king, elated by the achievement of his mariners, decreed that it be called the Cape of Good Hope. Having got that far, it was then only a matter of time before succeeding explorers, each one extending the knowledge of those before, reached India, thereby establishing a maritime trade link between Europe and the East. But it was not until 100 years later, when in 1580, Francis Drake, circumnavigating the world in his little ship, the Pelican, became the first Englishman to describe this southern end of Africa. He wrote, "We ran hard aboard the Cape, finding the report of the Portuguese to be most false, who affirm that it is the most dangerous cape in the world, never without intolerable storms and present danger to travellers who come near the same. This cape is a most stately thing, and the fairest cape we saw on the whole circumference of the earth, and we passed by it on the 18th of June." The Portuguese, though trading regularly with the East, made no attempt to establish a base at the Cape, and it was left to the Dutch, challenging the Portugal's monopoly of the Eastern trade, to make use of the Cape as a port of call. And it was those same brave servants of the Dutch East India Company who sailed round the Cape, who between 1616 and 1622 discovered considerable portions of Australia's western coast, as did later in 1642 Abel Tasman. The Dutch, however, made no attempts at that stage to establish a base at the Cape, despite frequent visits ashore to barter meat from the native Hottentots, to collect fresh water and make minor repairs in the relative security of Table Bay. It is surely a remarkable fact in South Africa's nautical history that the first sea-going vessel built and launched by Europeans at the Cape anticipated permanent European settlement by some 44 years. In 1608, the English East India Company's ships Ascension and Union arrived in Table Bay to secure refreshments and to build a small vessel, for which they had, of course, brought the necessary materials. Their crews first built a small earthen fort for their own protection, and after 3 months, the new ship was completed, launched, and was named the Good Hope, and then sailed eastward in company with her parent ships. 5 years later, the company directors in England, the English East India Company, were under pressure from some of their captains to form a permanent settlement in Table Valley. And in 1620, the English captains, Schilling and Fitzherbert, actually proclaimed King James as sovereign of all the territory, extending from Table Bay to the dominions of the nearest Christian prince, only to have their noble gift rejected by the authorities in London. And so it was left to the Dutch in 1652 to be the first to establish a permanent settlement at the foot of Table Mountain, there to organize a regular supply of water, meat, vegetables, and so on for the ships using this halfway house on the long haul between Europe and the rich East Indies. But not for very long. Within 50 years of this, grave events in Europe taxed, indeed overtaxed, the strength of the Dutch and led to the decline of Holland's maritime strength. The 18th century saw England and France disputing the hegemony of the seas and contesting the possession of colonial and mercantile empires. By the end of the Seven Years' War, the Indian Ocean was virtually a British lake. But in the middle years of that century, there were years of conquest. There were also times of profound economic change, of scientific endeavor, and of great discoveries. Thus it was on the 14th of March, 1771, that Captain James Cook arrived in Table Bay to replenish his ships and land his sick before returning to Europe after his first voyage to Australasia. In his journal entry for the 15th of April of that year, he described the Cape's benefits enthusiastically. He wrote, "The whole town may be considered as one great inn, filled up for the reception of all comers and goers. Upon the whole, there is perhaps not a place in the known world that can equal this in affording refreshments of all kinds to shipping." As you know, he returned to the Cape in his later voyages in 72, 75, and again in 76, adding to his early testimony that, "As there are few people who are more obliging to strangers than the Dutch in general at this place, and no place where refreshments of all kinds are to be got in such abundance, we enjoyed some real repose after the fatigue of so long a voyage." With Britain's Eastern Commercial Empire threatened by the French, the directors of the East India Company in 1781 urged the seizure of the Cape as the key to India's security. But an expedition under Admiral Johnston, sent out for this purpose, was forestalled by the arrival of French warships, and for the next 2 years, France enjoyed a brief ascendancy in the Indian Ocean. England's setbacks in North America about this time had several important consequences. As a result of defeats there, England focused attention more and more on the East, thus accelerating the growing importance of the Indian Ocean. Forced to look elsewhere for places to settle its large convict population, the British government in 1785 conceived plans for such a settlement at the mouth of the Orange River, the river which marks the southern border of Southwest Africa, now so prominent in the world's news. But a naval survey of the region quickly established the physical impossibility of a settlement there, and the plan was scrapped, and Botany Bay was chosen instead. It's very interesting to speculate, particularly today, with Southwest Africa so much in the world news. It's interesting to speculate on the course of history and see how the face of contemporary Africa might have looked if those enforced migrants of British stock had gone to Southwest Africa instead of to Botany Bay. As you know too, the first fleet to Australia rested in Table Bay from the 13th of October until the 12th of November. purchasing valuable supplies, plants, seeds, animals, which were established on arrival here, leading to the name of Farm Cove. I think we're more or less in the middle of it, aren't we? Here, is it? There, sorry. Unfortunately, the English surgeon, naval surgeon, Bowes, reported less favorably than Captain Cook. He complained, "Nor do I conceive there is any part of the Dutch possessions better calculated to exemplify the character of Dutch avarice than Cape Town. Every article, while the fleet lay there, was advanced to treble its usual price. Nevertheless, Cape Town was to remain a vital link in the lifeline of Australia's early settlers. Not only did the Second Fleet make an essential stop there, but ships were regularly sent from Sydney to Cape Town as the most feasible source of supply until the new colony here could supply its own requirements. In the early days of the 19th century, the importance for Britain of these eastern trade routes and the threat posed by French naval units based on Mauritius led the British to seize the strategically vital Cape from the Dutch, first as a temporary measure in 1795 and then permanently in 1803. And from then until now, it has been the British Navy which policed and guarded the Indian Ocean. But with the Napoleonic Wars over, Britain began to take these eastern sea routes for granted. And later, with the opening of the Suez Canal in 1869, Britain's interest in the maritime affairs of the Cape Colony dwindled, so that the colonists themselves felt constrained to organize the defense of their own shores. Without ships, these first early naval units were land-based. For Australia and Australians, the maritime importance of the Cape through more recent years, to some extent, has been a corollary of Suez, its significance rising and falling with the prevailing availability of the Suez Canal for shipping, in peacetime no less than in war. This, I think, is a point worth remembering. It is no less true today than it has been in the past. And with the Soviets now astride the Red Sea, with naval bases in Aden on the northern Asian shore and on the southern African littoral, there must be considerable uncertainty about the value of Suez in any crisis situation, genuine or contrived. The first of the local naval forces in South Africa was short-lived and was probably never officially recognized. It was the Port Elizabeth Naval Volunteer Brigade, raised in July 1861 by a Captain Chapman, who had previously commanded a naval brigade in India. Although the Lieutenant Governor inspected the new unit, which mustered about 100 all ranks, and promised to arrange for the issue of small arms and, too, for heavy guns, the unit met with the disapproval of the CNC Africa Station and seems to have been absorbed into the Port Elizabeth Volunteer Artillery in 1862. It was a Russian war scare, which provided the unlikely occasion for the establishment of the second naval unit. At that time, the Imperial Government had already made provisions for garrison artillery to defend Cape Town's port against commerce raiders, but Durban remained undefended. The citizens of Natal, alarmed at their colony's lack of seaward defenses, persuaded their colonial government to permit the recruitment of a unit of part-time volunteers who would serve the guns on Durban's bluff. The outcome of the debate as to whether an army or navy unit would best suit led eventually to naval uniforms being decided upon,
and the Natal Naval Volunteers thus came into being. In 1885, the old Cape Colonial Parliament passed an act transferring the assets of the original Simon's Bay Dock and Patent Slip Company, as it was then known, to the British Admiralty, or rather, in the quaint language of the law, to the commissioners for the executing of the officer of Lord High Admiral of the United Kingdom. In 1898, after diplomatic exchanges between London and the Cape about this vital point on the world map, the colonial government prepared to vest ownership of the dockyard site in Britain. While that debate was pending, Sir Alfred Milner, a British High Commissioner in South Africa, wrote confidentially to the Attorney General in Cape Town, saying, "I have gone into the question of the control of the waters of Simon's Bay with the Admiral. It turns out to be a matter of the greatest possible importance. The use of the anchorage to the Navy would depend on their absolute control of the movements and anchorage of such merchant vessels, and the right to exclude them, if necessary, from a space of water on which the Admiralty is going to spend two or three million pounds, naturally for its own vessels. The Admiral thinks that unless the command of this water is by some means or other obtained, the Admiralty would not undertake the work." From time to time, other statesmen in Britain and elsewhere have commented on the value of Simonstown, always acknowledging its unique importance. During the 1890s, Kaiser Wilhelm naval expansion program contributed directly towards an early decision to build Simonstown docks. As European power rivalries extended towards the close of that century, the constituent parts of the British Empire began to show an increasing willingness to contribute to common security. At the Colonial Conference of 1898, the Cape Prime Minister, Spring at that time, allowed himself to be so swayed by the feelings of the Jubilee year as to promise to finance the construction of a battleship for the Royal Navy. His Irish extravagance, however, was quickly curbed by a nervous Cape Parliament, which commuted his undertaking to an annual contribution of £530,000 to the Royal Navy. The importance of British naval supremacy was amply shown during the Anglo-Boer War of 1899-1902 by the British Navy's ability to exclude any other European power from the conflict in South Africa. I wish that situation still obtained. It was the Anglo-Boer War which gave the Natal Naval Volunteers its baptism of action inland. At the Siege of Ladysmith, at Escort and Colenso, and in other actions as part of the Royal Naval Brigade, which fought far from the sea. 4 years later, the Corps was again mobilized to participate, once again ashore, in the suppression of the Zulu Rebellion. Defence development at that time was delayed by political preoccupation with the Union of the South African colonies. But with Union accomplished in 1910, a further step forward was possible. And in 1912, the new South Africa Defence Act made provision for the establishment of a South African division of the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve, which came into being on the 1st of July 1913. When war broke out in 1914, the RNVR South Africa Division was at once mobilized, and 12 officers and 267 ratings were placed at the Admiralty's disposal, many being used immediately to serve aboard the Royal Navy's cruisers then on the Cape Station. The Union itself was little touched by the war at sea. Von Spee's squadron had been menacing, however, and disguised commerce raiders like the Wolf had sunk ships and sowed mines off the South African, and indeed the Australian coast too, in 1917. The Great War taught that unpreparedness was expensive, and the early 1920s saw a new wave of naval enthusiasm in South Africa. The Union's merchant marine was small, a mere 24,000 tons in 1924. But provision was made for the training of young merchant seamen aboard an obsolete 1886 vintage British cruiser, the HMS Thames, purchased privately, brought to South Africa and renamed the General Botha in 1921, General Botha after South Africa's first Prime Minister. It would be very difficult, ladies and gentlemen, very difficult indeed, to overestimate the value of the role played through the years by this training ship in the development of South Africa's mercantile marine and our naval forces. At the Imperial Conference in 1921, it was agreed that South Africa would assume responsibility for the hydrographical survey of its own waters and that the British Admiralty would provide the craft. This led to the creation of the South African Naval Service, proclaimed on the 1st of July, 1922, although the men and ships had been commissioned some 3 months earlier. It was a very inauspicious start, more particularly as South Africa's Secretary for Defence, for Finance, refused the £100 required for a renaming ceremony for the three ships which had been taken over by Britain. He did approve, however, £20 for the actual repainting of the names. Two trawlers became HMSAS Immortelle and Zonnebloem, while the survey ship was rechristened HMSAS Protea. The RNVR, South Africa, fortunately, continued to flourish under the direct command of the British Commander-in-Chief, Simonstad. In addition, a patrol section of 30 trawler skippers and second hands was formed in the RNVR. They could be trained quickly to use their little ships as minesweepers in the event of war. The activities of the European dictators in the 30s were beginning to dispel some of the lassitude which had previously manifested itself everywhere whenever matters of defence were discussed. The South African government informed the Admiralty of its intention to provide naval personnel in the event of war to man armed merchant cruisers, to arm merchant ships, to provide control staff for merchant shipping, signalers, examining and contraband personnel and craft, auxiliary minesweepers and their crew. Little was done towards working out how all this would be achieved in practice, however, perhaps because the South African government was then beginning to move towards a position of neutrality. The want of well-founded plans was illustrated in the government's action, or inaction, if you like, on coastal defence. In 1939, the batteries at the Union's ports were almost totally obsolete, and any new equipment would take time to arrive and be installed. As the war clouds then thickened, and the storm became more and more threatening, South Africa decided to borrow the Monitor Erebus from the Royal Navy. She was not to be a naval unit, however. Instead, the South African artillery were to provide the gunners, while the remainder of the crew were to be recruited by offers of 3-year contracts advertised in the public press. In the event, however, the scheme was never implemented. South Africa in 1939 was faced with a constitutional crisis. A new government and a declaration of war. Defense planning, inadequate as it was thrown into worse confusion, and only the large numbers of willing volunteers enabled the Union to meet her initial and urgent commitments to find seamen gunners for the armed merchant cruisers and for other services immediately required for the control and protection of merchant shipping. Within a few days of the Union's declaration of war, naval officers in charge were installed with their staffs in Cape Town, Durban, Port Elizabeth, and East London, with personnel for port war signal stations, examination and naval control services, and so on. But it was a navy without ships. The advent of war once again drew attention to the Cape as a key point in naval strategy. Standing as it does between two southern oceans, whose control by the Allies was vital to secure the link between the eastern and western worlds. Despite Allied superiority in warships, a superiority which diminished sharply in 1940 with the fall of France and the entry of Italy to the war, the Royal Navy possessed insufficient cruisers to provide protection for massive mercantile marine upon which the survival of the empire depended. With the Royal Navy unable to provide more than a few warships to operate occasionally in South African waters, it became obvious that the Union would have to provide largely her own maritime defences. As we have seen, the South African naval services were now defunct in all but name, while the coastal batteries around the nation's port were largely obsolete and useless. Certainly none of the guns at Cape Town or Durban could have done anything to prevent Graaf's Bay from causing wholesale destruction had Langsdorff chosen to bombard those ports when he rounded the Cape in late October 1939. Fortunately, the Graaf's Bay was under orders to avoid enemy contact wherever possible, and by mid-December it had met an ignominious end. For the time being, South Africa's contribution to the defence of her coastline rested squarely on the shoulders of the South African Air Force. Five squadrons of what were pretentiously called fighter bombers were immediately stationed at the main ports, where the obsolete aircraft rapidly became completely unserviceable. Recourse was then taken to a handful of Junkers 86s, taken over from South African Airways and imperfectly modified into bomber reconnaissance aircraft. In these machines, South African pilots undertook a continuous series of hazardous searches in cooperation with RN units, investigating unidentified ships and the numerous and invariably false sightings of new U-boats by nervous merchantmen. These operations were made more dangerous by the fact that the crew's only safety device on ditching was a partially inflated tube from a tractor tire. Nevertheless, it was from these modest beginnings that the SAF, the South African Air Force, launched a routine patrol service which continued and expanded throughout the war, and indeed, which continues today. Meanwhile, steps were taken to establish a new South African naval service. General Smuts approached Rear Admiral Halifax, a retired RN officer living at the Cape, to head the intended unit. In the discussions which followed, it became obvious that the Admiral had undertaken an unenviable task. Firstly, there was the problem that the unit would fall operationally under military control. Anathema, surely, to any sailor. Even this difficulty anticipated matters somewhat, however, for it was also discovered that through some anomaly in legislation, the RNVR South Africa could not legally be transferred to Halifax's new command. It became necessary, therefore, to constitute an entirely new unit, the Seaward Defence Force, which came into being on the 15th of January 1940. Additional problems now became apparent as defence headquarters in Pretoria passed down a number of ill-considered decisions which made it difficult for the new force to recruit individuals from the RNVR, South Africa. The Quartermaster General's early insistence on treating the Seaward Defence Force as an army unit added merely to the Gilbert and Sullivan appearance. Little wonder then that the unit was initially known disparagingly as the Seaweed Defence Force. Nevertheless, progress was made as Halifax and his staff persevered in spite of confusion and many annoying obstacles. A start was made with the conversion of 15 trawlers into minesweepers, each armed with a 12-pounder and a pair of Lewis guns, and a pair of mounted depth charges. It was the German raider Atlantis which brought the Seaward Defence Force into action for the first time in May 1940, when a minefield was discovered off Cape Agulhas. Admiral Halifax immediately concentrated his meagre forces to deal with the threat, for large troop convoys were being expected from Australia. In the event, and I think I spoke to somebody here tonight who said he went through South Africa in 1940, so if it hadn't been for Admiral Halifax, perhaps he wouldn't have been sitting here tonight. In the event, however, the heavy seas, which so hampered minesweeping, also betrayed the mines, most of which broke adrift and destroyed themselves. And no ships were touched in this field, although sweeping continued until March 1941. The discovery of this threat and the growing possibility of U-boat attack coincided with the closing of the Mediterranean to most Allied shipping, as war with Italy became now imminent. The Admiral therefore urged an immediate increase in the strength of his forces. By June, he was authorized to raise these to 37 minesweepers and 15 anti-submarine vessels. Not all of these were forthcoming at once, however, and there were difficulties in finding adequate equipment for the anti-submarine craft. We only had 4 ASDIC sets in the whole of South Africa. Much of the burden of vigilance along South Africa's coasts continued to fall upon the shoulders of the South African Air Force, who by now had acquired Ansons and Marylands for coastal patrol work. There was a regrettable tendency, however, to regard this essential work as a rest cure for pilots returning from desert operations. Little attempt was made to train air crews in this highly specialized task, and by the time they had begun to absorb something of the technique of seaward reconnaissance, they were posted back to squadrons in North Africa. While the routine continued, extensions were slowly being made to the Union's maritime defenses, and early in 1941, Walvis Bay, again today very much in the news, Walvis Bay was equipped with coastal batteries. Late in March that year, tragedy struck, however, when the aircraft returning Admiral Halifax from an inspection of the new installations crashed north of Saldanha, killing all aboard. The years 40-41 also saw vessels of the SDF engaged on several occasions with the searching and seizure of neutral shipping. 2 major operations were mounted in cooperation with the Royal Navy in 1941 to intercept Vichy convoys from Madagascar. The first of these, called Operation Kedgeree in August, failed hopelessly because of poor communication equipment and the slow speed of the South African vessels, which could only make 8 knots in the open sea. A second attempt 2 months later was a great success, for a Vichy convoy was seized after being shadowed by the mine clearance flotilla, and no further convoys rounded the Cape from Madagascar before the seizure of that island in 1942 by an Anglo-South African expedition, of which I may say, sotto voce, I was a small part. With the war becoming concentrated in North Africa and the Middle East, and with the western central sector of the Mediterranean littoral in Axis hands, supplies of both men and materials were routed round the Cape. The volume of shipping on that route was as large as it was valuable, and Allied operations in Africa were critical. German submarine successes against Allied shipping on that route show what a profitable area this was for raids on those vital supply lines, vulnerable also further north by this time to Japanese submarines. It's also worth mentioning that in 1943, women entered the naval services as what we call SWANs, South African Women Auxiliary Naval Services. Nearly 300 women served in this branch, not only as clerks and secretaries, but also to help man, if that's the right word, to help man the fixed defences round the Union's coast. It was a SWAN, in fact, who first fired a controlled minefield in June 1944 after an unidentified crossing into Saldanha Bay. At the foundation of the Seaward Defence Force, it seemed merely wishful thinking that its units would eventually serve outside South African waters. It came as a great boost to morale, therefore, when it was announced in December 1940 that the Union government had agreed to a British request to provide 4 anti-submarine whalers for service with the hard-pressed Royal Navy in the Mediterranean. South Africa sent her 4 best vessels, the Southerns, whose excellent steaming qualities were expected to reduce the delay in their arrival in the new theatre. They were soon equipped with anti-aircraft protection, crewed with volunteers, and on the 15th of December 1940 left Durban as a flotilla under the command of Lieutenant Commander True. Exercises were carried out en route, give the crews, very necessarily, a chance to shake down as a team and to give them some idea of what their new duties would entail. And early in January 1941, they even took part in a submarine hunt. And by the 11th of that month, they were at Alexandria, where they were attached to the command of Captain Local Patrols. Now, the Southerns had arrived at a time of rare early Allied successes. The imposing Italian fleet had already suffered a series of setbacks, notably, you will recall, at Taranto, and was little inclined to continue the small ship and convoy actions which had cost it so dear. The Italian submarines, too, had had little to show for their losses. On land, Wavell and O'Connor were achieving one of the biggest routs of the war, and their offensive, spearheaded by the Australians, was in full swing. There was little call for anti-submarine patrols at this juncture, and Admiral Cunningham, CNC Mediterranean, decided to use the South African ships as escorts along the Libyan coast on the supply route, which provided Wavell's armies with the material and supplies to continue their dashing advance. Here the main opposition was provided not by enemy warships, but by aircraft. The Luftwaffe's dive bombers had suffered but little in the Battle of Britain and enjoyed great success in the Mediterranean, where, skillfully flown and opposed by scantily equipped RAF, they even threatened to prevent the passage of supplies altogether. The Southerns, therefore, found themselves in the role of anti-aircraft rather than anti-submarine ships, despite being named the 22nd anti-submarine group. It was during this time that Southern Maid was detailed to take the senior naval officer inshore squadron to Tobruk, which had fallen the previous day. On the 24th of January, she was one of the first Allied ships to enter the port, which was to become symbolic of the struggle for victory in the Western Desert. At this stage, Southern MAID was still inadequately equipped with anti-aircraft weaponry. So the officer's wine store was employed to persuade some Australians in Tobruk to provide a lorry, and a visit was paid to the perimeter defences about 7 miles off, where a large haul of captured Italian automatic weapons and ammunition was awaiting removal. A selection was made, and the guns, still on their field mountings, were lashed to the deck. Sufficient equipment was also taken for Southern Flo, which followed her sister to Tobruk on the 29th of January. Never, I imagine, has a bottle of gin gone further. In 1941, and the years immediately following, the operations of South Africa's small navy, apart from duties at home, had been concentrated in the Med, primarily on these convoy duties, minesweeping and salvage work, heavy tasks which were performed with courage and distinction, not, however, without loss of men and ships, making a vital and valuable contribution to the prosecution of the land war in Africa and the defeat of the Axis in that theater, and assisting materially in reopening the Mediterranean and its ports to Allied shipping. The switch of operations at that time to Southern Europe and the Balkans saw South Africa's little ships, then in Greek and Italian waters, clearing mines, assisting convoy duties, and so on. And here again, honor was bought with lives and ships lost. The foundations for South Africa's post-war navy were already being laid while the conflict was still in progress. In August 1944, the Union government accepted 3 frigates of the latest type as a gift from Great Britain. The understanding was that these ships should be crewed by South Africa and placed at the Admiralty's disposal. Difficulties with manning the new vessels was anticipated with their larger complements, but by then there had been a fortunate reduction in routine minesweeping operations around the Union's coastline, and several of the trawlers and whalers had already been laid up pending disposal, and other technical personnel were kindly returned by the Royal Navy. In November 44, HMSAS Good Hope, the first of the 3 Loch-class frigates, was commissioned. Her sister ship, HMSAS Natal, was commissioned in March 1945, and 2 weeks later established something of a record. For while actually en route to her working up course, she came across the survivors of a merchantman torpedoed by a submarine. She soon secured an ASDIC contact and went into action. The crew, with only 4 hours of shore training, using anti-submarine equipment, which was quite new to most of them. Despite this handicap, however, Natal, only 6 hours after leaving the builder's yards, sank U-714. The excitement over, she continued to her working up course and thereafter was posted to escort duties in the Western Approaches. Excuse me. With the end of the war, the SANF, like its sister services, was drastically reduced in size. Apart from the 3 frigates, only the mine layer Spindrift, the 2 boom defence vessels and 11 harbour defence motor launchers were retained. Nevertheless, even this embryo navy was considerably stronger than that with which the Union had fought most of the war. 39-45 had underlined the importance not only of the Cape as a sea route, but of the maritime services which South Africa herself could provide, despite the fact that the country was comparatively little industrialized in those years. For example, over 7,500 merchant ships and 2,500 naval vessels were repaired in Union ports during the war. Hundreds of vessels were armed or received extensive refits, and after the magnetic mine made its appearance, more than 4,000 ships were fitted in South Africa with degassing equipment. In addition, South Africa had provided millions of pounds worth of supplies, ship stores and fuel to vessels calling at her ports. South Africa now became conscious to an increasing degree of the importance of providing for her own naval defense. In May 46, the SANF was formally established as a unit of South Africa's permanent force, with an initial establishment of 60 officers and 806 ratings. In the next year, the service expanded as two modern ocean-going minesweepers were purchased from Britain and renamed Bloemfontein and Pietermaritzburg, and a flower-class corvette renamed Protea was converted into a hydrographic survey ship. With Simonstown occupied by the Royal Navy, the SANF in 1948 transferred its headquarters from Cape Town and Saldanha to Salisbury Island in Durban. Between 49 and 53, two further additions were made in the shape of W-class destroyers, the Jan van Riebeck and Simon van der Stel, named after the first two Dutch governors at the Cape. In 51, the SANF changed its name to become the South African Navy, and in the following year, the forces vessels dropped the HM before SAS. Another interesting development was the establishment in 1951 of the South African Corps of Marines. This was formed out of the old Coast Garrison Artillery and Anti-Aircraft units, but the experiment lasted only for 4 years, and the Army eventually resumed control of the anti-aircraft units, while the coastal artillery was retained by the South African Navy. One of the oddest consequences of this brief existence of the Corps of Marines was that an army brigadier, as naval and marine chief of staff, took command of the Navy. In 1955 came the signing of the historic Simonstown Agreement with Britain. From South Africa's point of view, this was important not so much because we guaranteed Britain the use of Simonstown in peace and war, but because South Africa itself now adopted far greater responsibilities than ever before for the defense of the South Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. And this at a time when Britain was finding the strain of her defense burdens increasingly trying. To fulfill her commitments under this agreement, the Union undertook to purchase large amounts of naval equipment over the next 9 years took possession of 4 modern anti-submarine frigates, 10 coastal minesweepers, and 4 seaward defense vessels. In April 57, the agreement was manifestly implemented when the Royal Navy formally handed over the Simonstown naval base to the South African Navy, thus ushering in what seemed a new era in the defense of the Cape Sea route. Cape Naval Radio was also gradually taken over by South Africa, and South African naval headquarters moved back to the Cape. Simonstown had never been intended to act as a main fleet base, and considerable work therefore became necessary to develop the facilities to cope with this new role. The early 1960s saw the beginning of intense political pressures on South Africa. In 1961, South Africa withdrew from the Commonwealth and became a republic. For a while, defense arrangements with her old allies remained largely undisturbed, although it was obvious that the new republic would have to develop greater self-sufficiency in weapons and munition production. Modernization of old equipment was now necessary, and the destroyers Simon van der Stel and Jan van Riebeck were given a new lease of life by conversion into helicopter carriers. In 68, conversions also began on the anti-submarine frigates, which were equipped with helicopters and new fire control, radar, and a more sophisticated communication system. Difficulties with refueling at foreign ports led the decision to acquire a fleet replenishment vessel, Tafelberg, in 1967. You may recall that Tafelberg came to Sydney in the latter part of 1968 as a part of a small South African naval flotilla. One of the most significant changes came in that year when the decision was taken to equip the South African Navy with Daphne-class submarines as a more potent deterrent to interference with the Cape Sea route. These, however, were the last vessels to have been obtained from overseas builders. Orders were placed in 77, 76 with French yards for more submarines and corvettes, but those, as you know, were recently cancelled last year as a consequence of the United Nations arms embargo on South Africa. Such developments in themselves predicated a new direction in South African naval policy. It has become apparent that the Western powers no longer attach the same degree of importance to the defence of their communications round the Cape, despite the evidence of the last war and the growing and alarming presence of the Soviet Navy in the Indian Ocean. Recent policy statements by the South African Minister of Defence and the Chief of the Navy show that the Republic has come to terms with this fact. To attempt to maintain or build a navy capable of protecting the West's lifeline is clearly beyond South Africa's capabilities. South Africa has now thus decided to concentrate on the defence of her own territorial integrity and the protection of her own developing seaborne trade, instead of squandering resources on the task of helping to secure the freedom of the seas. For the traders of those countries who obstruct, denigrate, and attack South Africa in international forums. The value of the Cape in modern strategic terms is currently much debated. The fact remains, whatever you say, the fact remains that the Indian Ocean is still the world's biggest oil pipeline, and South Africa sits astride it. But the strategic value of Southern Africa seems apparent to the Soviets, who with sinister foresight for years have put South Africa under attack in the United Nations, subtly inducing others to assist. Mineral-rich South Africa is now threatened militarily, as you know, largely through proxy troops, tens of thousands of which, armed and equipped by the Russians, are in Angola and Mozambique, and indeed elsewhere in Africa too, directed and advised by top Russian generals, aided by Soviet aircraft, flown and operated by East Germans. The Soviet Navy today grows stronger and yet stronger in the waters between Africa and Western Australia, with bases well established and politically subjugated allies. You may have seen last week there was a question in Parliament in Canberra about the growing strength of the Russians in the Indian Ocean. For Australia, there are, as I see it, four main sea routes to Europe and the northern hemisphere of the political West. Firstly, round the base of South America, a difficult and lengthy passage. Secondly, via Panama, with a communist-dominated Cuba at one end. Thirdly, Suez, with the narrow southern entrance of the Red Sea under Soviet domination. And fourthly, the Cape, now under intense pressure from the communists and their allies. What is the point of trying to sell your beef and your minerals to Europe if you're not going to be able to deliver it, if nothing is done to help protect these access routes. It is to keep that region of the world free that South Africa is now fighting, to maintain its territorial integrity, and it is to the keeping of the adjacent seas open and free that South Africa's small navy is dedicated. In 1945, a South African naval officer said, "Let us remember in our salutations the men of our own little navy, so young in years, so worthy in seafaring achievements. To that little navy, we already owe much. But it is not enough that we should honor it for what it has done in the past. Rather, let us keep and preserve it for what it may do in the future." Ladies and gentlemen, those beliefs, those words are as valid now as they were then.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.